From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, a suspected case of Ebola in Washington, D.C. adds to growing fear the deadly virus is spreading from West Africa, where thousands have died.
Ebola is not a very contagious disease, although it's deadly and it's scary. It's not transmitted through casual contact. But when we do get these imported cases, I'm confident that we won't see much secondary spread.
Also today, push and shove. Opposition groups clash in Hong Kong as pro-democracy protests continue. And as Turkey joins the anti-ISIS coalition, airstrikes fail to stop advancing extremists near the Syria-Turkey border.
I don't think that you'll see Turkey unilaterally act against ISIS without fighting for some sort of degradation of Assad's powers.
All that's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nina Maria Potts with the latest world news. Pro-democracy protesters have called off talks with the government in Hong Kong, blaming the authorities for failing to protect them, in clashes with pro-Beijing demonstrators. The protests have been going on for more than a week, with Hong Kong democracy activists angered by China's plans to block election candidates. Hong Kong's leader has offered talks to resolve the situation, but clashes broke out between people allegedly angry about the protests and between those demonstrating against China. China says the student-led demonstrations in Hong Kong are illegal. Journalist Paul Martin is in Hong Kong. He says the students have been joined by thousands of other protesters.
They've been there for days, and not only students. Yesterday, when the weather was good, there were literally several thousand regular families, many of them Westerners who have jobs in the financial district here and with the banks, that were enjoying the sunshine, just sitting around all over the place in the main center near that area. And where all the buildings and all the office and the government offices are.
U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has welcomed a move by Turkey to pave the way towards joining the fight against ISIS.
We view that as a very positive development.
Chuck Hagel has also said that the U.S. does not intend to create a zone to protect refugees in northern Syria. Islamic State militants are closing in on the northern Syrian town of Kobane in intense clashes despite airstrikes in a situation that's deteriorated rapidly over the past 2 weeks. A hospital in Washington says it's quarantined a patient with symptoms that could be associated with Ebola. The move follows news that an American television team is being flown home from Liberia after a cameraman became infected with the disease. From Washington, Simon Marks reports.
This latest case will unsettle the US government. A patient being treated just miles from the White House after flying to America from Nigeria. Howard University Hospital says the symptoms are consistent with Ebola. Separately, an NBC News team led by one of America's best-known TV correspondents will be quarantined for 3 weeks after a cameraman became infected in Liberia. Events that challenge the official US position that the country is prepared for an outbreak.
A Ugandan doctor infected with the Ebola virus has arrived in Germany for treatment. He's the second patient to be treated recently in Germany for the virus that has killed over 3,000 people in the past year. Ira Spitzer reports from Berlin.
The patient, whose name has not been released, had worked with an Italian aid group helping Ebola patients in the African country of Sierra Leone. He was flown to Frankfurt overnight and placed in an isolation ward for treatment at the Frankfurt University Hospital. Ira Spitzer, Berlin.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Unemployment in the United States has fallen to a six-year low. Almost 250,000 new jobs were added to the economy last month, helping push the unemployment rate to 5.9%. Nick Harper reports from New York.
Strong statistics for September. 248,000 jobs created and unemployment pushed even lower. A fall from 6.1% to 5.9% means the US jobs market now has its lowest out-of-work rate since 2008. After a sluggish week for Wall Street, stocks jumped. Good news for the workforce, but the average hourly wage slipped by a cent and weekly working hours crept up. The White House has welcomed the figures, saying they show the economy has bounced back from recession more strongly than others. Nick Harper, New York.
UK Prime Minister David Cameron has promised Afghanistan's new president continued support from Britain as the country's forces wind down combat operations there. Mr. Cameron is the first world leader to visit Ashraf Ghani after he took office 4 days ago in a power-sharing government with his presidential rival Abdullah Abdullah. The British Prime Minister said the UK would continue to offer military training and support for the Afghan economy. And speaking in the capital, Kabul, he said Afghanistan's security forces are now highly capable.
It is striking how far they have come. In 2001, there were no Afghan security forces. Now there are four Afghan army brigades in Helmand province alone. And across the country, more than 340,000 Afghan troops and police are leading 99% of all operations.
Google's removed tens of thousands of nude photos stolen from celebrities' iCloud accounts and posted online. On Thursday, the company was threatened with a $100 million lawsuit by lawyers representing some of the stars. And that's the latest from Feature Story News. I'm Nina Maria Potts in Washington.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. A person who recently travelled from Nigeria is being tested for Ebola in a Washington, D.C. hospital. The individual is reportedly displaying symptoms associated with the deadly virus. The move follows news that an American television team is being flown home from Liberia after a cameraman became infected with the disease. And in Texas, health officials have confirmed they've ordered at least four family members of Thomas Eric Duncan to remain in their apartment. He's being treated at Texas Presbyterian Hospital for Ebola. Dr. Amesh Adalja is an infectious disease physician, and he spoke to me about the importance of tracking down those people who came into contact with Mr. Duncan.
It's important to bring this web together because when a person is in contact with an Ebola patient, when they're symptomatic and exposed to their blood and body fluids, they are at risk for contracting Ebola. So in order to prevent any secondary transmission and to get a handle on this and prevent it going any farther than it has, you need to find who his most intimate contacts were and observe them for 21 days, which is the incubation period of Ebola, having them check for fever, other signs and symptoms to make sure that they haven't contracted Ebola. And if they do develop a fever or symptoms, you rapidly test them to see if their symptoms are secondary to Ebola or something else.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the transition. It's something that's talked about a great deal through blood and bodily secretions. But can you give us some examples of how this is being transmitted?
Well, when I say blood and bodily secretions, I mean things like blood, vomit, diarrhea, bodily fluids. And what really ends up happening is people take care of individuals and they are exposed to these fluids in the course of taking care of them. And that's what we've really seen spread it in the African setting.
Right. In that case, what do you then make of the UN chief of the Ebola mission, Anthony Bambury's comments that Ebola could, as a virus, become airborne in what he called a nightmare scenario?
I think that it's not something that's really in the realm of possibility for Ebola. All viruses mutate, but we've never seen a virus that is spread through blood and body fluids acquire the ability to be spread through the air. Think of HIV. That spreads through the blood and body fluids as well, and it's been through millions of infections in humans and has mutated a lot. It's one of the most mutable viruses, but yet it's never acquired the ability to go airborne. Another point is that when a virus mutates to go airborne, it's not just a switch it throws. There's a series of mutations that may actually make the virus unable to do other things. So what if it becomes airborne but is not pathogenic for humans anymore? It doesn't cause disease in humans. So I think it's not a one-to-one trade-off. It becomes airborne and more virulent. It may end up losing a lot of capabilities if it became airborne, but there's no evidence to believe that it's going to become airborne or it has the capacity to do so or even that it needs to do so.
Mm-hmm. Airport screening has become an important factor in this conversation, hasn't it? But I'm reading that perhaps something as simple as a good dose of painkillers or anti-inflammatories taken by people trying to escape those affected regions may be able to get them through past that screening process.
It's definitely true that drugs like Tylenol and ibuprofen can suppress a fever response. And that's why they're doing multiple readings, which makes you more likely to catch a febrile episode. The other thing is it's not just fever screening. They are also doing questionnaires with people, asking them, have they been in contact with Ebola patients? Mm-hmm. And that's also going to rely on people being truthful, but that's another measure that's been added to our exit screening strategy from these Ebola-stricken countries.
An American cameraman, we understand, has also been infected, tested positive for the Ebola virus while he was working in Liberia. It's been described as having mild symptoms. Can you have cases where the outlook is better than others based on those early symptoms? Or is it impossible to say?
It's hard to say, but we do know that people do survive from Ebola, and there are varying degrees of severity. Not everybody, for example, has hemorrhagic manifestations. Not everybody bleeds. Not everybody has, not everybody needs to be on a mechanical ventilator. Not everybody needs blood pressure medications to support. So people have a varied course, and the milder the symptoms, the better. But it's going to be hard to see, because a lot of this depends upon when he was infected and when his symptoms started, and how quickly he was received supportive care, things like IV mm-hmm. fluids, anti-nausea medications. That type of care will really play a big role in how his course progresses.
As a doctor and someone who specializes in infectious diseases, do you think the CDC has got their preparations right for this Ebola threat?
I do believe the CDC has got its preparations right. We've been preparing for the event of U.S. cases for quite a while. We knew that this was the largest outbreak of Ebola ever, and the CDC has been advising hospitals and healthcare providers about the possibility of individuals traveling here and being diagnosed here. What I'm more concerned about is the fact that this patient in Dallas had presented to a hospital and was sent home once, and I want to emphasize again that physicians and healthcare providers need to be particularly astute and emphasize travel history with their patients.
It's going to be tough for them, though, isn't it? If there's not an honor code in place, if people are desperately trying to get to the United States for better treatment, they're going to disguise the fact that they are carrying Ebola.
Right, that's always a risk, and that seems to be what happened in the case here, that this patient knew he was exposed to Ebola and yet traveled regardless.
How do you mitigate for that?
It's going to be very hard, because people have free will and can do things like that. But what's reassuring is that Ebola is not a very contagious disease. Although it's deadly and it's scary, it's not transmitted through casual contact. Mm-hmm. So when we do get these imported cases, I'm confident that we won't see much secondary spread, because this is a disease that requires a certain environment for it to spread widely, and the United States is not that environment.
Dr. Amesh Adalja, an infectious disease physician. This is FSN Reports. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby says ISIS forces in Iraq and Syria are changing tactics as US-led airstrikes continue. Admiral Kirby said ISIS fighters have altered their communications and tactics and are getting better at concealing their operations. Meanwhile, fighters of the Islamic State are continuing to advance on the strategic town of Kobane, close to the Syria-Turkey border. This despite coalition airstrikes and Turkey's announcement that it will be joining the International Military Alliance against the IS militants. Freelance journalist Laura Wells is in Istanbul.
Well, Turkey did pass a military motion late Thursday, and it entailed three major points. Turkish troops will be able to enter Syria and Iraq. Secondly, foreign troops are allowed on Turkish soil, but even U.S. bases such as Incirlik will only be allowed for logistics, not active missions. There will also be an establishment of a possible security zone, perhaps in northern Syria, to protect its border. And there is a bit of Turkish land in Syria around the grandfather of the Ottoman Empire's tomb. Perhaps this could be used for refugees. They've also said that they've asked the UN to establish a no-fly zone over Syria, perhaps to weaken Assad. That being said, we do not know necessarily what Turkey will do. We only know what its concerns are with the coalition and its goals.
Can you explain to us why the Islamic State fighters advancing on Kobane is of such significance to the regional situation and this fight?
Well, the Islamic State would like to take over this large swath of border. It's already taken much of it around Kobane, which is both a canton and a town in the semi-autonomous area in northern Syria, which is ruled by Kurds and has been for a while. It has been the worst siege yet that we've seen on Kobane in recent days. ISIS has reached the gates. There have been no strikes by the Turkish military up till now, although there have been airstrikes by the International Coalition on ISIS in the area, but none have seemed very effective. If ISIS were to take over this area, they will have a large part of the Turkish-Syrian border. Also, the Kurds have threatened that they will end the peace process with Turkey, which has been in effect over a year. And PKK, even last weekend, claimed the lives of three Turkish police officers, they said, as a warning. This is something that that Turkey is extremely worried about. They do not want renewed violence in their own borders with the PKK. This has been a small civil war over the past 30 years. So they're very wary of the international coalition arming Kurdish fighters. And they certainly have not allowed northern Syrian fighters, the YPG, to have any arms given to them.
So if U.S. led coalition fighter planes have failed to stop the advance of our IS militants in this area, putting Turkish planes up there perhaps won't do any good either. Is there a call in the country for Turkey to go in on the ground?
There is not a lot of political will for Turkey to get more involved in Syria and Iraq. The supporters of the current administration, they believe that Turkey will act in its best interests. And what Turkey, the administration, wants right now is to ultimately get rid of Assad and also create more Sunni representation within the government of Iraq. Turkey has said, even recently, the president said that Assad is as dangerous as ISIS, and it is actually the reason that it developed the Syrian regime. So I don't think that you'll see Turkey unilaterally act against ISIS without fighting for some sort of degradation of Assad's powers. I think, you know, they're asking the UN for no-fly zone over Syria is in a way to degrade Assad, since he's been barrel-bombing much of the rebel-held areas.
Laura Wells in Turkey. Now, rain may have drenched pro-democracy protesters, but tempers in Hong Kong appear to still be running hot. Protesters clashed with opponents who support the Chinese government, forcing police to separate the crowds after confrontations began in a key shopping district. Officers formed a human chain between the two groups, but no arrests were reported. Tens of thousands of demonstrators have been flooding the Hong Kong streets throughout the week, demanding free and fair democratic elections for 2017. Paul Martin is a journalist based in Hong Kong, and he spoke earlier to LBC's Lisa Aziz.
Actually, they are the students and the activists are contemplating the offer that was made, but it's heavy rain out there today, so I don't know if they're going to make a decision. There are many more police there. Yesterday, there wasn't a single police officer in sight. Today, there's police officers there. And there's still a very large crowd of thousands of students there. What happened is there's a garrison here, which most people don't know about, of, I believe, 6,000 People's Liberation Army soldiers that are based there to defend the Hong Kong and South China area. And I believe they have all kinds of armored vehicles and everything. Now, they are not intending or have not been ordered to interfere. They are leaving that from Beijing at the moment up to the local authorities and the police. Finally, I just wanted to add that these students are bravely, against the rain out there, and they've been there for days. And not only students, yesterday when the weather was good, there were literally several thousand regular families, many of them Westerners who have jobs in the financial district here and with the banks, that were enjoying the sunshine, just sitting around all over the place in the main center near that area. and where all the buildings and all the office and the government offices are. So it wasn't just the students. I spoke to a few dozen different people, and a lot of them were not just students. The majority of people who practice democracy in the sense that they voted in C.Y. Leung, the chief executive, four times, greatly outnumber the people that are protesting. So, in fact, in reality, one could say and interpret that the majority of people in Hong Kong are probably quite satisfied with the way things seem to be going.
Journalist Paul Martin in Hong Kong. And finally, we return to Ebola and look at Peter Piot, the man who first diagnosed the virus in the mid-1970s. Peter went on to become a leading figure in the fight against the deadly disease before taking the role as an Undersecretary General of the United Nations. In this report, produced for the Financial Times, Mr. Piot talks to the FT's science editor, Clive Cookson, about his experiences.
In 1976, the young Belgian medical worker, Peter Piot, travelled to Yambuku, a remote Congolese village suffering from a devastating outbreak of a mysterious new illness. His work there helped to contain and identify the deadly Ebola hemorrhagic fever, which kills 90% of its victims. The death toll in Yambuku in 1976 was about 300. Peter went on to become one of the outstanding public health leaders of his generation, directing the global fight against HIV/AIDS for 13 years as head of UNAIDS. Earlier this year, Peter returned to the once flourishing village. I caught up with him in his director's office at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and I started by asking how Yambuku has changed since his original visit almost 40 years ago.
Today, I must say, there is kind of generalized decay. It was very sad to see. It's a very idyllic place, you know. It's beautiful. It's like a postcard, nearly. But the buildings are kind of imploding, literally, collapsing some of them. They're no longer coffee plantations. There's no electricity, no running water, no shower, no fridge. But the hospital has, you know, has a dedicated physician who I find is a hero because, you know, to work in these circumstances is fantastic. It requires a lot of courage and dedication.
Going back to Ebola, you and your colleagues managed to stop the original outbreak, yet Ebola still recurs. We have an outbreak in West Africa now, as you know. Why does this very stoppable disease keep on coming back?
We are an accidental host, in a sense. The virus is hiding somewhere, most probably some fruit-eating bat, and then we are becoming infected in an accidental way, either during, you know, hunting or preparing, you know, the meat, because bats are eaten also. And we are not a good host, because the virus kills us within 2 weeks, basically, 90% of people. And we are not a good host, because then the virus has to jump yet to another host. So we still don't know where the reservoir is. And it's also a disease of poverty, because every single outbreak up to now has happened around the hospital, where basic hygiene was not respected, where injections are given with the same needles to different patients and so on. So it shouldn't happen. If a patient with Ebola would end up in London in a hospital, for example, I'm quite sure it would not give rise to a major epidemic.
Now, you're best known as a public health leader for your work on another disease that originated in animals, which is HIV/AIDS. And I was interested that you found signs that back in 76 there was HIV infection, although, of course, no one had heard of the disease then.
Yeah, it's very interesting that AIDS was described for the first time in 1981 in the United States. But then we were seeing quite some patients coming from Central Africa when I was still working in Belgium. We went there. I went with some colleagues from Zaire, from the US. We found a major heterosexual epidemic. The dogma was that this is a gay disease, which of course is absurd, you know, from the perspective of a virus, doesn't work. And But then I was always very intrigued, how long has this virus been around? Where is it coming from? And one of the first clues that it had been circulating in Central Africa was because we had preserved our blood samples from 1976 during the first Ebola outbreak. We had tested thousands of people in that region. And when the antibody test became available for HIV in 85, we tested these sera, and what did we find? There was already HIV in Yambuku area 5 years before the disease was described. That was very new, but it was at very low level. And 10 years later, we went back in 86, and it was at the same level. So what we found is that in an area where there isn't amplification of HIV through multiple sex partners and so on, it can remain at very low level.
So what is anything we can learn from these two very different diseases, Ebola and HIV/AIDS, that have moved from animals to people, about how we might treat anything that jumps out of the animal kingdom and bites us in the future?
New viruses will continue to emerge. We're seeing it actually in the most visible way with the regular appearance of new types of influenza viruses, yes, usually coming from China. And that's also originating in animals. It's ducks or chickens and sometimes, pigs. So that's the first thing. It will continue. Even if infectious diseases, thanks to antibiotics, vaccines and so on, are on the decline, we will continue to see new infections. And secondly is that we should think of our health as the health related to the health of animals, of other animals, I should say. We call it one health. And many new infections come from animals, and we'll see more and more of that. And a third example of that is antimicrobial resistance. We are under threat of bacteria that may no longer be treatable. We already have it for tuberculosis, some forms, but also for kind of very common infections that you can acquire in a hospital.
Peter Piot talking to the FT's science editor, Clive Cookson. And finally tonight, and we mean finally, FSN Spotlight. Simon Marks explains.
On FSN Spotlight today, a few words about this programme. This is the final edition of FSN Reports, a move we're taking with regret in a bid to reallocate resources here at FSN's Washington headquarters. That is not management speak for downsizing. Everyone associated with this programme, both on air and off it, will continue working for FSN, and you'll still find our content regularly updated online at featurestory.com. You'll still hear our hourly news updates on many stations across the country. It's been a pleasure and a privilege for us to bring you this programme over the past 12 months, and we hope you've enjoyed the stream of news stories that we've covered from FSN's bureaus across the country and around the world. I want to take this opportunity to thank our affiliate stations for bringing the programme to you, and also for being so understanding about its departure from the airwaves. You can stay in touch with us, as ever, on Twitter, where you can interact with us at Feature Story. And we look forward to hearing from you. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Friday and final edition of FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend. Goodbye.